Welcome to the Catchcast. I'm Mark Ovenden. Now, it's not often in broadcasting that someone from behind the lens or microphone becomes as well known as the people in front of them. But today's guest has produced and directed so many of our culturally significant shows we've seen and heard that it would be impossible to have missed him. He's directed programmes as diverse as the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Concert to Little Britain, Blackadder to the Eurovision Song Contest, and from The Marriage of Figaro to The Marriage of Pauline Calf. He's worked with some of TV's funniest glitterati, Catherine Tate, Jasper Carrot, Griffith Jones, Harry Enfield, Steve Coogan, French and Saunders, John Sessions, to name but a few, but perhaps the most cherished of his partnerships were with Victoria Wood and Julie Walters and Celia Imrie, Duncan Preston, Pat Routledge, etc. Without whom, how would he have given birth to comedies of 1,000 quoted lines from sketches like Two Soups and Akon Antiques? Not only that, but he's a wonderful man who's highly passionate about public transport. Welcome to the Catchcast, Jeff Posner.
Have you finished?
That's the longest intro I've ever given.
I bet it is. And none of it's true, fair listeners. None of it. I'm very honoured to be on your show because having listened to lots of important people like Christian Wolmar, who in my eyes is a kind of transport guru, to have me talking about transport, well, I hope I live up to it. But anyway, here goes.
I know you've got a lot to say about it, and we're definitely going to cover all of those areas. But I wonder if I could sort of indulge ourselves first and take you right back to childhood in Marylebone. And could you please tell us what you remember about TV and radio and maybe transport as well at the time when you were growing up?
Well, I don't know where this Marylebone thing came from, because I think it's an IMDb thing, which for the listeners who don't know is a kind of Bible of who's who in the industry. And they say I was born in Marylebone. Well, strictly speaking, I was, because my mother was there when I was born, miraculously. But it was in a London clinic, and I was delivered into this world by a man called Jack Suchet. Sharp-hearing listeners of yours will notice the Suchet moniker, because he went on to produce some very famous sons, one of whom, David Suchet, became a Poirot in his time.
Wow.
So I think that as old Jack delivered me and smacked my body, not for the first time in my life, he kind of passed over to me some of the showbiz patina, and it stuck with me ever since. So I grew up really wanting to go into an area, television, that nobody in the world wanted to go into. But I'll come to that later on. The thing was, I didn't stay in Marylebone for too long, because after I got out of hospital, we moved to East Finchley in North London. Mm. Now, your sharp-eared listeners will know that East Finchley has one of the finest tube stations on the London Underground, and I spent a hell of a lot of time on the tube station and around the tube station, admiring it and loving it. And that's where I got bitten by the transport bug, because from my house, I could hear the trains at like 11 and 12 at night going to bed in their little depots in East Finchley. Isn't that cute?
Oh, it's lovely. And I love the sound of a distant train rumbling. And your station as well, East Finchley, it was one of the Holden styles. It's probably one of my favourites too. I love that beautiful archer designed by Eric Ormonier, which is pointing the way south through the longest tunnel on the underground.
Absolutely. And here's a little exclusive for you, Mark. I used to stand on the platforms, because there are four platforms of East Finchley. The outer two are the tracks that go into the West End and the city carrying the Northern Line. But the inner two tracks are really reserved for London transport, as it was then, staff only, because that leads to the depot. And I wanted like mad to be invited by somebody to go for a trip into the depot. And I stood on that platform for ages, but nobody ever did. So maybe if anybody from Transport for London is listening now and would like to offer me a quick trip down from East Finchley into the depot, I'd love it, love it, love it.
Oh, we'll see if we can get that arranged for sure.
Thank you.
And when you were a child then, did you have any other inklings that you fancied working media? You mentioned this idea of television, and perhaps it wasn't a career that people thought they would go into. I wonder, what was the first thing you saw and thought, blimey, I really fancy being involved in something like that?
Well, you're absolutely right. Nobody went into television. When I told members of my family that's what I was going into, they looked at me as if I was, you know, do you mean repairing televisions? No, I don't. I mean working in and producing programmes. And they gave me a blank look because, of course, at that time, especially in North London, everybody became a lawyer, an accountant, a doctor, a vet, and all of those kind of things. And that's what all of my family wanted me to do. But I didn't. And they just couldn't comprehend, because in those days there was no media studies, there was no invitations for apprenticeships from BBC and ITV. There's only two channels, BBC and ITV, and that's all it was. So it was really difficult to get into, and nobody wanted to go into it. But an important date in my life is the 27th of May 1966.
What happened then?
I'm glad you asked that. Well, I was watching a programme called Ready, Steady, Go. Now, this was a programme produced by the London TV station at the height of the London and UK sound generated by the Beatles and the Stones and everybody else. It was when London and the UK was the centre of pop. This was a pop music programme that used to be on just after the news at 6 o'clock at night on a Friday night. And the slogan was, "The weekend starts here." And I'd watch it as a fan, but then I started to get interested in how the programme was put together. And it was shot with a lot of cameras and they cut from one to the other. On the 27th of May, the Rolling Stones performed Paint It Black. And the director, a gentleman called Michael Lindsay-Hogg, shot it in such a way that I literally leapt into the air. Even now it gives me goosebumps. And about 30 years after the programme was on air, when the internet had started, YouTube managed to carry a clip of it. And I looked at it again and I thought, I can see what excited me so much in those days. Because I thought, if that director can produce excitement in the audience, such as I experienced with what he did with the cameras and cutting and zooming and all kinds of things, I want to do that as a job. And I was bitten. And for the rest of my life, I've always wanted to not emulate him, but create that kind of excitement in the audience. That was the day I was bitten, and I can trace it down to that one show.
Wow, that's amazing that you can remember that particular moment as being the spine tingler that turned your career. That's incredible.
Well, I urge any listeners to go onto YouTube and see it. The thing is, and here's a nerdy thing for you, there are two versions of it. Nearly all the recordings were made on film in those days, and it was a studio recording. So they went on after the credits, and I urge people to watch a version that's got bits after the credits, because that's where the excitement happens. And right at the very end, the music fades and you can hear a studio hand going, "Nice one, Mick," in the background. So there, didn't expect that, did you?
Not at all. Did this bug-biting moment happen around about the time that you were thinking about your job? I mean, going to college or university, or what did you actually do before you got involved in the media?
Well, I went to university because I thought that's the way to get into television, because there were, as I said, there were no courses or anything, and there were no schemes reaching out into the public as there are now. In fact, everybody in television tried to put you off. And there was some vague link between the theatre and television. You had to work in the theatre because that meant you were kind of sympathetic to actors and all of that. Well, that's a load of tosh for a start, because actors just like us. And see, I didn't want to go into the theatre. I wanted to go into television. So I spent the next 6 years trying to get qualifications. And at the end of all of these qualifications, I wrote to the BBC and said, "Look what I've got. Let me in." And they said, "What university did you go to?" And I said, "Well, I went to Essex University." And they said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Pulsner. We're full. Goodbye."
Goodness.
And that happened sort of regularly until I banged on the door of the BBC, number 5 Portland Place it was then, the appointments department. And I said, "You've got to let me in. I'll die otherwise." And guess what? They didn't. No, they did. I had an interview, and at the end of the interview, the guy said, "Well, thank you very much. There is a job called a floor assistant, which you might just qualify for, but actually we've just filled them and there won't be any vacancies for the next year."
What happened next?
I went away and I thought, what am I going to do? This was just before Christmas 1973. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I got a Christmas job. And then suddenly I saw an advert in The Guardian saying relief floor assistants wanted at the BBC. I applied and I got in.
Wow.
So I got into the BBC that way. But I can tell you, there was no altering what I wanted to do. I wasn't, you know, everybody said, well, why don't you do something else until you get it? No, I've got to get into the BBC. And that's what I did. And I started as a floor assistant. They used to call them call boys in the early days, but there was a slight scandal involving a government minister in the 1950s and call boys. And so they changed the name to floor assistant, which sounds like you mopped the floor, but is now kind of like a runner.
So no mopping involved?
No mopping involved. And actually, you didn't get people teas and coffees, really. Your job was to help run the studio floor. And I loved it. And then I became a stage manager and then floor manager and production manager and all of that. So I did all the jobs that you could do. And within 6 years, my head of department said to me, would you like to go on the director's training course? And I said, would I? And so the BBC sent me on the director's training course in 1980. And again, it was just, I can't tell you what excitement it was for me.
We are still chatting on the Catchcast with the unparalleled award-winning Jeff Posner, who's joining us here on the Isle of Wight.
What wonderful mountains you have in the Isle of Wight. I never knew, Mark, how beautiful it was.
It's virtually K2 sticking out the centre of the island. What was your first director credit? How did that come about?
Well, round about Christmas 1980, my head of department, entertainment department, I should add, by the way, and they did comedy and variety shows, as they were called in those days. He got a call from BBC managers and said, well, we have a show called Revolting Women that is produced by some people in the features department. They don't have much comedy experience. Would you have a director who's used to working with actors and, you know, a new director to do the comedy side? And he suggested me. And so up I went. I met the team and they were absolutely lovely. There were, I think, four women and one token man, as they called him. And they wrote and performed in all the sketches. And I kind of said, well, what happens if you did this here and this here and this here? And they're like, yeah. Anyway, we recorded the pilot and it was sent up to the head of pilots at the BBC. And they managed to get the series. And I got a phone call at the beginning of the next year from the very excited producer. I think she was called Lynn Webster, who phoned me up and said, Jeff, guess what? We've managed to get the series. Thank you so much. And I thought, thank you so much sounds a bit odd to me. And she said, that's the good news. Here's the bad news. You're not doing it.
Oh.
And I said, could I ask why? And she said, well, we've decided we wanted a woman to direct it. And then she left the end of the sentence hanging in the air. And I said, and I'm a man. Well, I had a big moustache in those days. I couldn't pretend. So with my tail between my legs, came back from Manchester and said, well, I didn't make it there. And marvellous head of department said, well, here's a compensation for you. How about you do 6 Top of the Popses?
Wow.
Now, for a young director who had no experience at all apart from a sketch show in Manchester, to let loose on Top of the Pops, I can't tell you how exciting I found that. And this was like going back to the Ready, Steady, Go days, you know. Everybody watched Top of the Pops and I had 6 of them to do and I loved every second of it. But it was music. And in those days, I realised that I loved doing comedy and I was torn between the two. And that's sort of been the story of my life, really. A pendulum swinging between comedy and music. It's a hell of a pendulum to have, I have to say. Do you have a pendulum, Mark?
Oh, it swings nicely. I just wonder, how does the director actually work? What does the director do? How do they form the programmes? How did you work on that first Top of the Pops? And I think you also worked on the Generation Game as well, didn't you?
Generation Game, Blankety Blank. It was all the kind of training you did, how to do panel shows, how to do sketch shows, how to do music shows. And only the BBC offered that kind of training. Let me explain the difference between a producer and a director, because there's a lot of misunderstanding. And entertainment is an area that's kind of different from drama. But the producer's job is a much more administrative job. When a producer gets a series, he gets a blank piece of paper and he or she constructs the programme around him and he or she chooses a director, unless he or she is going to direct it themselves. So the producer gets the scripts together, books the team, does all the administrative work and the financial work. And the director does the creative work, but producers would say, hold on, we're creative too, because we create the environment for you to do your job in. He or she realizes either the script, if it's a comedy or a piece of music, realizes it for television. And that involves either several cameras called multi-camera or a single camera. In those days it was film, but nowadays, of course, it's a mobile phone. So you can either work in multi-camera or single camera, but the director does the shots, if you like, and directs the actors and creates the visual style of the program. The producer is much more administrative. And in our department, you couldn't become a producer unless you'd been a director. So that was fine by me. I did a couple of years directing Top of the Pops and Little and Large. I did The Generation Game, Blankety Blank, and all of those kind of things the department wanted me to do. And then they said, would you like to start producing? And I said, well, yes, please. Mm. And so then I started producing. But the first real show that I directed came at the end of 1981. The director of Not the 9 o'clock News, a lovely guy called Bill Wilson, was promoted in the BBC to become a producer, just like I've been talking about. They had a spare slot of a director on quite an established programme. So I went to meet one of the producers, an inspirational man called John Lloyd, who's been responsible for so much of British comedy. And neither John nor I can remember what was said at the interview, but he said yes to me, and I joined Not the 9 o'clock News, and this was the first huge comedy that I'd let myself into. And I, again, learned such a lot from John. I learned a lot about comedy. I learned a lot about working with scripts and working with actors, all of which came in so useful later. And John imparted one really important note to me.
What was that?
Well, thank you for asking. It was that no matter what the sketch looks like, however nice you make it look, or however good the actors are, unless the joke in the middle isn't good enough, then the sketch won't work. I spent hours shooting this sketch, shot on the border between Russia and Alaska, of an exchange of prisoners in the snow. And of course, the prisoners usually met each other face to face. And then there was one step to the left and the Russian prisoner went to the left and then the one went to the right and it turned into a little dance. And then in the end, they got cross with each other and they went back to their own sides. It doesn't sound very funny now, and it wasn't very funny then, but I spent 3 hours up a crane putting the snow down, the fire brigade were involved, it was a whole thing, and it looked very nice. We finished 20 minutes before lunch, and John came up to me and he said, I've got this sketch, which is just a two-hander sketch between Rowan and Mel Smith, and it was about a spy being recruited, and it started the first programme of the series. And it goes to show in 20 minutes, we did a joke that was really good enough to start the series. And in 3 hours, I did a joke which actually ended up in Programme 5, which in those days was where you put all the stuff that wasn't really great, but you wanted to use it. And Programme 5, by that time, everybody's been hooked to the programme, so it didn't really matter what you put in Programme 5. But that was the lesson I learned. Understand what the joke is and whether it's good enough. And I've remembered that ever since.
Jeff, apart from comedy, we share an interest in transport and the underground specifically, don't we? And over the horizon there on the other side of the mountain, ex-London Underground trains ply between Ryde and Shanklin. Give us an idea about what you love about transport and perhaps talk about a few of your favourite parts, so to speak.
Well, I used to ride on those ex-London transport trains because they used to run on the Northern Line, and I absolutely adored the underground system, the whole underground system. In those days, you could get what was called the Twin Rover, which meant you could travel on any bus and any underground train in the London area for 8 and 6p, which is about 42 pence. And that gave me the right to explore all the underground. And I got fascinated by it, by its history. And even when I worked at the BBC, I was one of those strange people who, instead of sitting down in the carriage, stood up so I could look out the window at the tunnels. But I knew what I was looking for. I was looking for the Marble Arch siding. I was looking for the Queensway crossover and the evidence of the 1908 Franco-British exhibition at White City. Mm. All marvellous stuff. And I just retained that fascination with London transport ever since then.
When you were looking out for the remnants of the old White City, did you ever spot there was an old big roundel sign on the station?
Yes. They did have permission on one of the open days in London to explore parts of that station, although parts of it that actually went onto the track were obviously out of bounds. But I actually went down into the station It's all gone for the Westfield Shopping Centre now, but you could actually go down and see the old station, which was, of course, called Wood Lane in the old days before White City came along and the line was extended up to West Ruislip and Ealing Broadway. But it's those little things. And when you come out of the tunnel at White City, you could see the remnants of the old train sheds and the old start of the Central London Railway. I'm just fascinated by it. And, of course, the stock that transferred to the Isle of Wight was my favourite tube stock, 1938 stock. So comfortable and so wonderful to look at. I hope you've kept it in good shape.
Well, as long as we could, but they did become a bit dilapidated, Jeff.
Well, it was 1938, so it's a few years ago for anything to keep going.
They used to run it up and down Ryde Pier, obviously, and the seawater rotted the floorboards underneath the carriages. And so there came a point where you couldn't put a wheelchair or couldn't stand there because there was always a worry that some people might fall through.
Oh, my goodness. And of course, wooden floors, that was the name of the game, wooden floors in trains, wooden floors in escalators too.
And they've also replaced that recently with some refurbished D-stock. So they still have these London Underground trains going backwards and forwards.
Yay!
Did you have a favourite station at all?
Well, I loved the red brick stations that were built in 1906. But my favourite was actually built in 1915, which is Maida Vale. Mm. Because before 1911, he says, being very nerdy, you used to have to build stations with lifts, which meant you had to have all of the apparatus for the lifts on the first floor, which meant the stations had two floors. In 1911, escalators were invented, and by the time they extended the Bakerloo line to Maida Vale and then Queen's Park, it had an escalator, so you didn't need a first floor, and the booking office was underground. So you've got this wonderful staircase from the street down to the booking office, and then a wonderful escalator. How could escalators be wonderful? Well, we think they are. And it went straight the way down to the platform instead of having these passages in between. So I love it. It's battling with a lack of kind of care and attention, which is unfortunately the case with a lot of underground facilities, which they don't have the money to keep painting them and keeping them looking great. But if you look for it, you can see some wonderful remnants of 1915.
Oh, I love that station. And the mosaic roundel on the wall as you enter as well is one of my favourites in the whole
system. Absolutely. Listen to us.
Well, I always tell people my favourite station is Southgate.
I know why.
You do know why, for the reason that there was a Charles Holden station from the 1930s. It's very, very Art Deco looking. But the top bit is allegedly the inspiration for Terry Nation for his design for the Daleks, apparently.
I didn't know that. Oh, Lord. I'm going to shoot up there after this broadcast, after I've taken the ferry across the mainland, of course.
And do not be exterminated on the way. Now, I'm going to pull you back now, if you don't mind, to your comedy in the early 1980s. And it must have been around about that time that you first became aware of the work of Victoria Wood and Judy Waters. I think they had their first series on Granada up in Manchester about the time you were working with Revolting Women.
Yes,
can
indeed.
Can you recall how you first met Vic and what your impressions of her were?
I nearly bumped into Vic when we were doing Revolting Women, but I didn't. Vic had a rather, let's say nicely, a rather sort of dissatisfactory connection with Granada. It was nobody's fault. The producer, who was very much rooting for Vic at the time, died just before the series was supposed to happen, and control passed to somebody who didn't really know Vic as well as this man called Peter Eckersley did. And so there were things that happened that Vic wasn't entirely happy about. So she was signed by the BBC, and of course, when she came to the BBC, the BBC turned around and said, "We will give you a producer who will give you whatever you want and make you great and all that kind of stuff." Anyway, I said to the BBC, "I've seen Vic in a play at the King's Head Theatre in Islington called Good Fun, and she's wonderful. Can I please produce the series?" And they said, "You're a brand new producer. We can't trust you with a new series. What happens if you mess up? You know, we've signed her from Granada and..." Anyway, there was a bit of lobbying that went on, and I didn't know at the time, and I only found out last year, that two friends of hers, one of them worked with me at the BBC and put my name forward, and out of the blue, suddenly I got called in and said, "Jeff, you're doing Victoria Wood." I was so, so pleased, and I must confide to you that of all the stuff that I've done, there's a small part of my heart that's got Victoria Wood written on it, because, of course, you know, I'm so proud of the stuff we did together.
Oh, and so you should be. I mean, it's something that, as we'll speak about, has just transformed so many people's lives. And I believe that not long after that, you got into preparing for the series. Where did you first hear some of the lines?
Well, Vic was very, very careful about not releasing the script to me until she was absolutely happy with it. Mm-hmm. And as the weeks went on, I said, Vic, can I see a script? No. Anyway, I got the call. Vic is inviting you up to her house near Preston to read through the whole of the first series, and just you, don't take anybody else, just you, and bring a stopwatch so we can time it and all of that. And I arrived at the house, and sitting on the floor was Julie Walters, and I sat on the floor as well. And the three of us read all of Series 1 of As Seen on TV, me doing the stage instructions and some of the male parts, and then everything else being written and read by Vic and Julie. And it was one of those treats that you can't really describe to somebody, because obviously the actors who followed that did an extraordinary job in bringing the script to light. But that's when I realised there was this special relationship between Vic and Julie that was a bond that you could not break, and they understood each other so well. We'd get to a sketch and then Julie would say, who's this person, Vic? And Vic would say, well, you remember the person we met in the library, or the one with the striped top? Yeah, it's her. And then Julie would come out with this voice, and it was just hysterical. I put the stopwatch on it, and sure enough, she'd written 28 minutes, which was a kind of BBC half hour. The ITV ones were much less because of the adverts, and it's much, much less now because of the adverts and all the promos that they do. But she was very pleased. She'd written 28:30, and I said, I'm afraid to tell you, Vic, although the script is extraordinary, I need an extra 5 minutes each week from you, so that's another 30 minutes, because I want to over-record, I want to do too much, so we've got some stuff in the bank that maybe some stuff doesn't work quite well and we want to use other stuff. She took it very well, but I realised, you know, what a pressure it was, but I've always done it that way and I've never regretted it. And that's why we got such good stuff in series one that really drew people. And don't forget, in those days, As Seen on TV was on BBC Two. It was considered not BBC One material because, A, she was not a traditional glamorous woman like Marty Kane or some of the other really big comedians who sang shiny floor stuff. B, she was from the North, and there weren't very many female comedians from the North. And C, of course, she was a woman. And in those days, comedy was very much a male profession. So the BBC kind of said, well, we'll put you on BBC Two and see how it goes.
Jeff, we have reached this point in your amazing career when you begin working with Victoria Wood, but can you believe we have to stop there? We could go on speaking for hours, I'm sure, Jeff.
My fault. I'm terribly sorry, listener. I bored you senseless.
Well, you haven't bored me, Jeff, that's for sure. We've been absolutely overjoyed to have you. Thank you so much for explaining so much to us today.
It's a pleasure, and it's wonderful being with you on the Isle of Wight.
And do rejoin the Catchcast next week for the second part of our chat with Jeff Posner.